Hi, Greg. You got a new book out. It's called Disunited Brotherhoods, Race, Racketeering, and the Fall of the New York Construction Unions. Well, I guess we were kind of wondering how high they were, how far they've fallen, and how race and racketeering figure into that.
Well, okay. Well, basically, back in 1968, the construction unions in New York City were probably the most powerful federation of local unions on the face of the earth. They had 250,000 members, all male, almost exclusively white, and the union was so powerful that when Richard Nixon needed a labor figure as his Secretary of Labor, he picked the head of the Building Trades Council here. However, that power was built on a foundation of sand, because those unions, well, besides being utterly racist in a city that was largely people of color at the time, it was also these were unions that were totally and thoroughly under the thumb of Cosa Nostra, the five families of Italian-American organized crime in New York City. And they were totally subordinated to the contract, because that power was not used to benefit the workers, it was used to benefit the bosses. And what happened was New York City was going through some serious transitions in the 1960s. Our city was, on the one hand, black and Latino workers got tired of being excluded from the industry, and led by a group of black radicals and communists, they organized themselves into these armed groups, which were called the Coalition. There were 40 different groups, more or less, but they were all collectively known as the Coalition. And they basically fought their way to integrate the industry. And I say fought. That's not a figure of speech. I'm literally involving large groups of people with baseball bats and chains and the occasional pistol or attack dog raiding job sites that were all white and forcing them to integrate.
Now, these were non-union job sites, right?
No, these were union jobs because the industry is 100%. Late 1960s, the industry in New York is 100% union.
Okay.
Everything from bodegas to skyscrapers is being built with union labor, but it's 100% segregated. There's only a handful of people of color in the unions. Some of the unions are all white. Some unions, like the plumbers, in 1968, they called a strike to keep their trade all white.
Wow.
So, yep. That was Plumbers Local, too. George Meany's local.
George Meany's local.
That's correct.
For those of you who don't remember, George Meany, longtime president of the AFL-CIO.
That's correct.
And, anyway, the coalition, unlike, the contractors or the developers, they weren't afraid of the big building trades unions and La Cosa Nostra.
Well, the contractors and developers, they weren't afraid of the unions because the unions were largely subordinated to the interests of the contractors. Because the contractors had used Cosa Nostra for many years, going back to the 1920s, as a way of regulating competition in the industry. So when they would bid a job for the developers, they would get together and prearrange how much the job was going to cost. It's called bid rigging. They had a quite elaborate structure. So the gangsters regulated the industry, and the gangsters got a percentage, and the gangsters also kept the unions in line. So basically, they weren't afraid of the unions. The unions worked for them.
Wow. Okay, and that probably, do you think that would have been much more difficult to achieve if the New York City building trades, going back to the 20s, let's say, had been more open racially?
Well, it would have been much different. I think a lot of things would have been different had they integrated long ago, you know, when they were founded in the 1870s. But unfortunately, they grew up segregated. That became much more pronounced through the 1920s when the gangsters took over. And basically, by the 1960s, that was the dominant trend. There were other things happening in New York in that period. Basically, these are the years when most of the factory jobs left the city. These were the years of gentrification when landlords got our rent control laws repealed, and the tenants who wouldn't move out so they could increase the rents got their apartments burned down. A good chunk of our city was burned to the ground in those years. And when the new apartments were built, they were built with government subsidies, and they were built non-union, and they ended up, of course, renting for much higher rents. So at around the time the industry was becoming integrated, the union's power was collapsing dramatically and rapidly, and because the unions had become so subordinated to the contractors and the wise guys, they were incapable of fighting that trend. And certainly there were a large pool of workers who'd been kept out who were suddenly able to get in the industry thanks to the coalitions. So suddenly the non-union contractors had a huge non-union workforce to rely upon. So we reach a point today where there's 200,000 workers in the industry, which is down by about 20% from the 1968 peak of 250,000 workers.
Which at that time was all union.
Exactly. Today the industry, about a half the workforce is non-union, 100,000 workers, but they do 70% of the work. So they work regularly. On the union side, most of us are unemployed. The non-union side is overwhelmingly people of color, black, Latino, South Asian, and Chinese. The union side is about a third people of color, with some trades, like the laborers and the carpenters, with us forming a majority. And also there's 4,000 women in the industry, which is a big change from the old days when it was all male. However, at the price of integration was the collapse of the unions. And on the non-union side, and mind you, almost every apartment building in New York City is built non-union except for luxury high-rises in Manhattan below 96th Street. Most of the city's residential construction is non-union. And on those jobs, the carpenters only get paid $8 an hour for a 10-hour straight time day. Laborers get paid as little as $4 an hour. Yep, folks, you heard me right, $4 an hour in New York City. Some of the contractors buy them lunch. They get them a sandwich because, really, $4 an hour, how are you going to afford to buy lunch? And how are you going to work if you can't eat lunch? So basically, it's all paid off the books. Nobody pays Social Security. Nobody pays workers' comp. Somebody gets injured, you hail a taxi and send them to the hospital. They don't call an ambulance. So there's no paperwork, so there's no workers' comp claim and no lawsuit. And it's an outlaw business. One Carpenters Union organizer referred to that side of the industry as the Wild Wild West, and it's a very accurate description. And that side is overwhelmingly non-union, and you start seeing non-union contractors creeping into previously unionized sectors. And that's going to be the dominant trend, and the unions have not really been able to do anything about it. Also, the thing with the organized crime was organized crime regulated the industry for the contractors, but the developers didn't like that because they kept prices inflated. So they had the government come in, and to a large degree, the feds have driven out the mob, but at the price of the feds running a number of the construction unions in New York, including my union. My union's run by a federal judge, the New York District Council of Carpenters. And the laborers, they also answer to a federal judge. And that's certainly weakened the unions even further, being under government supervision. So basically, you have a situation where the unions here are really on the edge of collapse.
Wow, amazing. But I was just wondering, we're having this big debate about immigration. And these workers, especially you're talking about these laborers, making less than minimum wage in this outlaw, more or less, construction industry. Are there a lot of illegal immigrants working under these conditions?
Yeah, a good chunk of those workers are illegal immigrants. Also, although on the union side, you do have a number of undocumented workers also, and particularly in the laborers. But, of course, they're organized, so they make a bit more than that, although I should point out there are union contractors that pay people off the books as well.
Well, I think I do remember reading in recent years, especially in things like asbestos abatement, where the laborers have been organizing that heavily, so they probably had a legacy of...
even in carpentry, even in drywall, which is the core of carpentry work, there are a number of contractors that pretty much openly pay people off the books. I mean, they don't go out and announce it, but it's widely known. There are certain companies in New York that are known for doing that. And some of the workers are immigrants, but not necessarily undocumented. Some of them are legal immigrants. There are workers who are native-born American citizens you'll find in those jobs working for cash. That's what we call it here. Working off the books is so common among union carpenters, we even have a name for it. We call it working for cash. And it's pretty common.
That's pretty wild, because even working for cash at those wages, I don't say you can really make much of a living in New York City.
No, you can't. I mean, basically, much of the construction workforce in New York City live a poverty-level existence.
Well, do you have any ideas or perhaps prescriptions for the future where these people, maybe they'll get desperate enough to try and get their unions turned around?
Well, at this point, I would have to say the unions have been so weakened for so long by racism and gangsterism and by a general mentality of being servile to the contractors and doing whatever the boss wants, that we're going to have to rebuild a whole new construction union movement from the ground up And we're going to have to fight to organize and fight to organize the whole industry. And basically, it's going to take nothing short of a citywide strike from the ground up by the workers to reunionize the industry in this city. And considering the present state of the unions, if and when that happens, the unions are probably fighting against it, realistically.
Yeah, well, see, actually, I've just the laborers just seem to me, and the carpenters might be comparable, too, to just these huge monolithic institutions that are just set in concrete, more or less, that with bylaws and constitutions and so on and so forth, where it's really hard to do much legally.
Well, you know, it's not even so much that. It's a question of their philosophy is, we have to support our, quote-unquote, our good union contractors. Now, as far as the bylaws and the rules and legalities, when it comes to stuff like stealing, or even when it comes to helping the contractors, they will cheerfully violate those rules in a heartbeat.
Yeah, but let's say if you start speaking up a whole lot, you know, those things could be turned right. See, what I'm thinking of is about the only thing I can see happening there is a real grassroots uprising of these really horrendously treated workers to turn things around, and hopefully they can get a lot of community support.
Basically, that's what it would take. Yeah, basically a revolt from the ground up, because, frankly, the unions aren't going to do it. I mean, okay, yeah, they do have picket lines here or there. They'll have the occasional token picket line, but as far as organizing the whole industry on the kind of scale on which it needs to be done, forget about it. They're not doing it, and they don't want to do it, because that would involve struggle, and also, they got to answer to the FBI and the Justice Department. That's the last thing the government wants, is a struggle. So they would certainly not tolerate it, and the contractors wouldn't be happy either, nor would the developers. None of the big shots calling the giving the orders would be happy with that at all.
Yeah, stability is real popular among people like that.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, in your book, is it? I'm sure that it's real factual and uses a lot of logic and so forth. Are there any really interesting people that you get into talking about in there?
Well, certainly I do discuss some of the organized crime figures who dominated our union in its heyday, like the former shop steward at the Javits Center for the Carpenters, a fellow named Anthony Fiorino, who was a professional handball player.
Oh, I've read about him in the Village Voice, I believe.
Yes, a man with very minimal carpentry experience. Good handball player, though. But a quite ferocious figure. He used to have this cart that the bosses gave him to go around the Javits Center. And the first time I ever saw him, this young stagehand, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "That's your shop steward, but don't say nothing to him, or he'll take you in a room somewhere and kill you." Now, I should point out, Fiorino never actually killed anybody, not in the room in the Javits Center or any other place, but that's how the workers looked upon him. But the bosses liked him so much they gave him a damn golf cart, so he didn't have to walk like the rest of us did.
Oh, okay.
Javits Center is about a half a mile long by a quarter mile wide. It's a big building, but he was too good to walk. So, yeah, there were people like that, and there was also the man who once at one time dominated concrete construction in New York City, a fellow named Anthony Salerno, but known to his friends as Fat Tony.
Oh, I think I've heard of him.
Yes, and Fat Tony Salerno, who was the underboss of the Genovese crime family, he also ran the commission, the body that regulated New York's five mafia families. He also ran the concrete club. So basically, every concrete job in the city, over $500,000, you had to ask him if you wanted to do that job. And if he said yes, you did it. If he said no, you didn't do it. And if the job was worth more than $5 million, it had to be done by SNA Concrete, a company which, coincidentally enough, just happened to be owned by Anthony Salerno. And he would pit the bid. Everyone else would have to bid higher than him. And, oh, nobody got to underbid Fat Tony. Or they would learn why they shouldn't do that. So, yeah, there were a number of colorful figures like that. Or there was Louis Muscatello Sr., he was an insurance agent from the Bronx, and there came a time as the conditions were collapsing in construction, particularly in residential construction, the drywall tapers local, which was part of the painters, led a strike. They actually reversed some of the abuses. So the wise guys went out, and they got a plasterer's local, Local 530, and they chartered it, and they put Louis Muscatello in charge of it. He was a fairly connected guy. He was an official in the Bronx County Democratic Party, well-known insurance broker. Never worked a day in his life as a drywall taper. You know, I mean, wouldn't know a 6-inch taping knife from a hole in the ground. But he ran that union for a number of years until he got sent to prison. And then he put his son in charge of it, which was kind of funny because his son was actually a contractor. So his son couldn't really run the union. They found some guy to be the president. But Louis Muscatello Jr. ran the union while Louis Muscatello Sr. was away in the penitentiary. And, you know, we had some colorful union figures. And that we had, like, well, of course, we had Teddy Moritas, who was our own local version of Jimmy Hoffa. He got indicted in one of the first big criminal cases, and he, well, shall we say, disappeared. Some folks invited him to meet them under the Dog's Neck Bridge, and, well, they found his shoe and like, his wallet. They never found Teddy. And then there was Fred Devine, one of our presidents of the district council, who he got indicted, I mean, not so much for criminal stuff, but because he had two mistresses, both of whom were on the union payroll. And he would, like, take them on private jet rides to Florida, ironically enough, to sexual harassment conferences. And it was, you know, it got to a point. He had a penthouse on the top floor of the district council of Carpenter's building. So he lived the high life. And he went to jail for that, but he didn't do that long. And the minute he came home from jail, there was a high-paying management job with a heavy construction contractor waiting for Freddie. Well, and they've had, we've had our share of colorful figures like that in the building trades here. And, of course, obviously the granddaddy of New York labor racketeering, a fellow named Robert Rendell, back in the 20s. He was a drugstore clerk from Nova Scotia, came to New York. The contractors liked him, so they put him in charge of a wharf and dock construction local called Local 1456. Fred Devine's local. It still exists to this day. And he was put in charge of the Carpenters Union after our last strike in May Day 1916. We won too much, and they took it all back. And he was the first person in American history to go to jail for labor racketeering.
Amazing. Well, real quickly, next few minutes, are there any heroes?
Well, you know, there's a lot of individual workers who stood up and tried to fight back and tried to resist. Certainly there are people who've risked everything to expose dirty jobs. Like there was a brief period when the feds came in. There were two business agents named Patty O'Neill and Mike Bellello. They came across a job where they literally split the building in half. One half of the building was being built more or less union. The other half was being built by a union contractor with non-union labor. The Park Central Hotel, and they exposed that. And, oh, yeah, they both probably got fired as business agents. Bellello was told he was, and I quote, not a team player.
Oh, I might say, too, listeners interested in corrupt unionism might check out laborers.org. It's not a union site. It's a private site with a lot of history. And anyway, Greg, we're about the end of our time here. How can people get a hold of this book?
Well, there's a couple of ways. My publisher, iUniverse.com, is a website. iUniverse.com, that's letter I, universe.com. You can find the book there. Also, of course, I'm on Amazon.com. You can find me under Disunited Brotherhoods into the search engine. You'll find me. I'm also on BarnesandNoble.com. So you can just go to BarnesandNoble.com, enter Disunited Brotherhoods in the search engine, you'll find me. Or you can go to your local Barnes & Nobles and just ask the clerk you would like to purchase a copy of Disunited Brotherhoods, and they will order it for you. So those are the ways: through Amazon, through BarnesandNoble.com, at your local Barnes & Noble store, or you can go direct through my publisher, iUniverse.com, and you can request the book from them. Or you can go to your local independent bookstore and ask them to order the book from iUniverse for you. And I certainly urge you to get the book. Again, the title is Disunited Brotherhoods, Race, Racketeering, and the Fall of the New York Construction Unions by Gregory A. Butler. And I urge you to pick it up. You'll find it very interesting, and it tells a very, actually very sad and shocking story that really needs to be put out there.
Well, I think there's some professors at the big university down the road in history and labor relations. Maybe they could pick it up as a text.
Most definitely.
To use. And, well, Greg, I tell you, Thanks for taking this time to tell us about your book. I can't wait till you can get one out to me so I can actually read it and then maybe talk more about it on the show.
Well, Bill, thank you much for your time. I really appreciate having this opportunity to speak to you and your listeners out in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois.
Okay, well, have a good weekend, Greg.
You too, Bill.